seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Lutz v. Short.
Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, unlike the cases earlier today, this is a very narrow case and really involves one issue, and that is the application of the dollar-for-dollar credit in a wrongful death case. Most of the issues we believe that were presented in the Court of Appeals were decided by this court in the Drillex decision. I think for the purposes of the oral argument, there were three rulings or three holdings by this court in Drillex that are germane to this case. Number one is the court held that under the plain language of Section 33011, subsection 1, the term claimant includes all family members or derivative beneficiaries. Number two is the court held in Drillex that the total of damages to be recovered by the family, that is, all the beneficiaries, are to be totaled and then subtracted from the total verdict rendered by the jury for all beneficiaries. And then finally, this court held that the remaining damages should be allocated among the parties seeking recovery based upon each party's percentage of the damages found by the jury.
If I recall correctly, though, in Drillex, we did not confront or address the issue about when all the individuals who are asserting claims on their own behalf, as they are here. They are saying that these are our individual claims. We have our own unique damages, and therefore we are entitled to our own money.
Well, I think that is a distinction without a meaning. If you go to the language of claimant in 33011, which talks about those situations where you seek injury for damages for injury to another person, which was Drillex, because the plaintiff in that case was alive.
In Drillex, the injury was to another person, and everyone was piggybacking off of the injury to that person. Here you have somebody who died, and as a consequence of that death, these folks have their own individual injury.
However, again, going back to the language, it talks about where you're seeking injury because of the death of another person, and that is referring, I believe, to a wrongful death or to a survival claim. The literal language of 33011, subsection 1, claimant, talks about where you seek damages because of the death of another person. And we believe that that brings in the encompasses the wrongful death and the survival claim. And that the same rules that apply in Drillex would apply in a wrongful death or survival situation.
Mr. Kipper, a wrongful death action is a statutory cause of action in which the legislature has designated certain beneficiaries to recover particular kinds of damages as a result of someone's death.
Correct.
Under your interpretation and the way the application of this interpretation would work in this case, essentially, one beneficiary could recover damages in their own behalf, walk away from the lawsuit, and absolutely preclude the other beneficiaries from recovering what they are entitled to do under the statute. How do we reconcile the legislature's intent, obvious intent by the plain meaning of the wrongful death statute with how you would have us interpret the comparative responsibility statutes?
2 points I'd like to make. First is, it is true that in the wrongful death statute, the individual, the statutory beneficiaries have their own claims, but they are derivative claims, and this court has held on numerous occasions that those claims are derivative. For example, if the decedent was greater than 50% at fault, it bars any recovery by the statutory beneficiary.
Before you move on to the second point, but it's derivative of the claim of the person who died, not of the co-beneficiary.
Well,
I mean, the derivative nature flows from the death of the person who then gives rise to the cause of action. It is not derivative of a co-beneficiary.
But the same argument can be made in Drillex, and that is that Texas, this court has recognized, instead of a statutory, a common law right to a loss of consortium where there's been a family member severely injured. That is not the family member who's injured in this cause of action. It belongs to the individual child, spouse, or whatever.
But the difference, there's a fine difference here in that under Drillex we were dealing with common law. And here we've got a statutory cause of action that the legislature has provided for certain people. So actually what we're having to do here is reconcile two statutory provisions. And that's what I'm trying to understand, because it seems to me that you'd probably even have to admit, I would think, that it would be very unfair for one beneficiary to walk away with the entire recovery and leave the other beneficiaries with totally incapable of recovering what the legislature said they should be entitled to recover. Would you agree that that's an unfair result?
Well, again, two points. One of the things this court said in the Drillex case is there may be some harsh results that are occasioned by this, but that's the way the legislature drafted it. Second is the fact that you have a statutory cause of action as opposed to common law. Again, this court has held numerous occasions that what the legislature giveth, the legislature can take it away. But third, and I think this is the most important thing, is what we are arguing, what we proposed in our brief, would eliminate that situation.
Do you agree with me it's an unfair result?
If someone who has damages from a purely justice, yes, that would be an unfair result.
If there is a way for us to attach the meaning to the comparative responsibility statute without abrogating the rights of anyone to recover under the wrongful death statute, then isn't that the approach that we should take?
Well, again, the same thing would be true in the Drillex. If you have one child who settles for a lot of money, which might cut off the rights of the rest of the family, you could argue the same thing. That would be unfair. That would be harsh as well.
But a factual distinction that your opponents make to Drillex is the fact that in that particular instance, all of the claimants were still before the court. And they use that as the means to distinguish Drillex and to attach meaning to the language in the statute. Would you respond to that argument?
Sure.
Why that's not a distinction with a difference?
That is, in my opinion, the only distinction that exists between this case and the Drillex case, and that is, does the claimant for whom you're seeking credit for the settlement payment have to be a party at the time of submission? And again, we'll get to it sooner or later. In McGovern, Joyce McGovern was not a party at the time of submission, but the Houston First Court of Appeals held that nonetheless, what money she received would be credited against her daughter, Lori Crane's, recovery in that case. Second, and we've supplemented a brief in the Profit case, which was decided within the last month or two by the San Antonio Court of Appeals, you had the parents who had a separate wrongful death claim and a separate lawsuit who were never parties to the lawsuit involving the spouse, the estate, and the children, and the San Antonio Court of Appeals held that nonetheless there would be a credit. Now, what I think the solution to this is, and it's the one we put in our brief and the one that I've given the handout is, and that is the simple solution is you go ahead and submit, the non-parties submit their damages, add them all together, subtract out all of the damages, which are the settlement credits, and then you divide what's remaining among the people who are still remaining the lawsuit.
Which specific statutory language do you rely upon for submitting the settled party who is no longer a part of the lawsuit?
There are a couple, Your Honor. Firstly, 71.010 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code talks about wrongful death claims. It envisions in that statute one submission for the entire claim. Texas, in this court, has long held that.
Okay, but looking under Section 33, probably 33.012.
That is correct.
Okay, what specific language under there?
There is no specific language, Your Honor, under there that would say you do this, but this court has, for example, or the legislature has authorized this system in other situations as well. For example, before, I believe, 1987, this court in Otis Elevator versus Russell in a wrongful death workers' compensation case said you had to put your actual damages in order to recover them so you could look at whether or not punitives were excessive or not. Then this court came back in Wright versus Giver Bill in 1987 and said, no, that's superfluous. We're not going to require that. However, the legislature has come back since Wright versus Giver Bill in 1995 and made the punitive damage statute apply to workers' compensations wrongful death cases and requires now that there be findings of, for example, economic losses, non-economic losses in order for the cap to be applied. And so we have in other situations, for example, This court has not addressed the situation, but at least one court of appeals has. In Wynn versus Cohen, dealing with the medical malpractice cap, the question was, if you have some settling defendants and the remaining defendant is subject to the cap, the court said you have to submit, or the plaintiff is entitled to request submission of the settling defendants in order to increase the amount of cap, which benefits the plaintiffs. This issue has not been addressed by this court. However, I think there is more than ample authority by analogy that would allow this procedure to be done. And I think it avoids the unfair result that Justice Hankison referred to. And again, what I have on the handout, we have three situations. One is plaintiff three is the settling party in all of them. One is where he settles for the exact amount awarded by the jury. Number two is where he settles for an amount less than what was awarded by the jury. And the third is where he settles for an amount in excess of what was awarded by the jury. This method, I believe, does at least two things. One is it gives some protection to the beneficiaries who are still in the lawsuit. But second, it also ensures that the defendants are going to receive their credit for the settlement, which was one of the goals and one of the policy issues that was addressed by this court in the Drillex case.
But in this particular instance, you have a party, a defendant who settled that particular party's claim, not the other's claims under the wrongful death statute.
The hospital settled with Ms. Walker and then dismissed the remaining, they paid $10 to the remaining.
But isn't that a distinction, though, the fact that we have someone who's bought their peace with a defendant and gone their way? And wouldn't it be okay for a defendant to decide to settle all the claims of a particular plaintiff and send them on their way?
Absolutely. What I'm saying is it's to the plaintiff's benefit if they want to have the settlement credit applied to a larger number to have the settling plaintiff submitted as far as their damages are concerned in order to allow them to recover more actual damages.
Well, what is wrong with the interpretation given to the statute by the Austin Court of Appeals that looks to 33.012B1 and looks at the language which says that the reduction shall apply to only the settling claimant's damages? It seems to me that's the specific language the Austin Court hung its hat on and that your opponents do today. I know you've come up with a different idea, but they hung their hat on some specific. What's your response to that?
The primary basis for the Austin Court of Appeals decision was, and if you think of it as a hub and the spokes of the wheel, you have the decedent here in the middle, and then you have the wrongful death beneficiaries on the spokes around there. What the Austin Court of Appeals said is you cannot put them all together. You have to look at each separate wrongful death beneficiary in conjunction with the particular decedent. And again, I believe it's inconsistent with the literal language of the statute, and two, I believe that it's inconsistent with what this court held in Drillex, because you can make the same argument, that is, you have the injured party, and then you have the wife and kids around there, and if you applied the Austin Court's rationale, then Drillex would not have been decided the way it was. Rather, you would have had to look at, for example, the son and the injured party, the wife and the injured party, the daughter and the injured party, and you would have had four or five or six different claimants, and that was not this court's holding in Drillex.
Except 33.012 talks about a settlement. If a claimant has settled with one or more persons, then the court shall reduce the amount of damage to recovered by the claimant.
Right. And this court held the claimant in Drillex included the whole family, not just one member of the family, or not just two members of the family. This court held that the term claimant encompassed the entire family. And that's why I think the Court of Appeals decision cannot be, on its conceptual basis, reconciled with this court's decision in Drillex, because otherwise you would have had to split up each claimant in Drillex in order to reconcile it with what the Court of Appeals has decided. I think also, in this case, we have the issue of the fact that Mrs. Walker, the one who settled in non-suit her claims, was a party to the lawsuit. And again, if you look, we believe that at the statute as a whole, there are certain parties, the defendant, a a seven person, and a contribution defendant all require that you be a party at the time of submission of the case to the jury. There is no requirement with respect to the term claimant. And this court in the Laidlaw versus City of Wilmer case held that where you have a statute and you have certain terms which are limited and other terms which are not limited, you don't apply that same limitation to the terms that are not limited, and we believe that that's what plaintiffs in this case are trying to get this court to do.
What is it the language in 312 says the court shall further reduce the amount of damages? The court shall further reduce the amount of damages to be recovered by the claimant with respect to the cause of action. Why does that language not specifically limit your ability to reduce the amount concerning Ms. Walker?
Because this court in Drillex held that the term the claimant encompassed the injured person, his wife, kids.
Right.
It was an encompassing term, not a limited term.
Right. Okay.
Seems to me that it would not be a viable distinction on whether or not the settling party was a party at the time of the verdict or not, because the solution would be for a defendant any time that they were faced with one defendant who settled that was a family member is just to make them be a plaintiff against their will.
Well,
I mean, you just would add them, and it seems to me it doesn't solve the issue.
The person persons who would benefit by adding the several plaintiffs back and including them in the charge would be the plaintiffs, not the defendant. Because, again, under the format that we're suggesting, it would raise the amount of damages from which the settlement credit would be subtracted. And so it would be beneficial to the plaintiff to have the settling plaintiff added back in. And also, there was four concerns that were addressed by counsel in the brief. One of them was, the second wife scenario. Well, that addresses that. The medical payment scenario, it addresses that. Also, if you settle out with the best-looking plaintiff or best witness plaintiff, it addresses that because their damages can still be submitted. This solution, I believe, addresses every single argument that's been raised by the plaintiff in the brief.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Fong.
May it please the court. Mr. Stephen Aldis will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. I think Justice Hankinson hit right on the issue. And the issue is whether or not this court will do away with approximately 100 years or more of wrongful death law in an effort to construe a statute where the wrongful death implications were never mentioned by the state legislature. I challenged them at the previous argument to come forward with any statement by the legislature. And when they enacted 33.012 or 33.011, that they meant to change this entire body of law and make these separate claims of each wrongful death beneficiary into one lump claim.
It talks about the death of another person.
I'm sorry?
The statute 33.011 talks about the death of another person.
Correct.
And it talks about that claimant shall include both that person and the dead person and the party seeking recovery. Well,
yes.
We know that the decedent doesn't have a cause of action.
That's correct.
So what does the statute mean when it refers to death of another person?
From the very beginning of the wrongful death statute, the Texas courts have construed it to be a derivative claim of the dead person, just as Justice Hankinson suggested. In other words, if the dead individual was more than 50% negligent, or back in the old days, contributory negligent at all, it would foreclose a claim by any of the beneficiaries. But what it does not say, and that is the purpose for it in the statute, too, because it relates back to 33.001, which says if you are 50%, more than 50% responsible, if the claimant is more than 50% responsible, you don't get it.
But the use of the word claimant is not limited to comparative responsibility. It's also used in terms of the settlement parts of the statute.
It's used throughout the entire chapter 33.
What did the legislature mean when they used the words death of another person in connection with settlement?
If I may, I'd like to approach over here the easel. I've got some exhibits because I can't explain without pictures. Let's just take this case.
what we have is we have Clifton Short, who died, and then we have the wrongful death beneficiaries as well as the representative of the estate. The statute, 33.011, says, and I'll quote it just to make sure I get it right, it says, in an action in which a party seeks recovery of damages for the death of another, the claimant includes both that other person and the party seeking recovery of damages. That's one claimant.
Clifton Short can't seek damages.
That's right. But assume for me he was in a car wreck instead of a medical malpractice case like this. Assume for me he was in a car wreck, and before he died, he settled with the automobile driver that was negligent on the other side. After his death, the family discovers that the seat belt was in fact defective, and that's another reason why he passed away. The family members then bring a wrongful death action against the seatbelt manufacturer. In that case, the statute says that if Clifton Short, while he was alive, received a settlement, it would apply against all of the other wrongful death beneficiaries.
But that's when he was still a claimant. Now he's dead.
But it says that each one of these people with Clifton Short is a claimant.
But there is no Clifton Short.
That's right.
Back to our facts.
That's exactly what the difference is between this case and Drillex. In Drillex, Jorge Flores was alive and making a claim at the time of submission to the jury. In this case, you had Jorge Flores, and I'll tell you truthfully and honestly, I cannot tell from the opinion written by Justice Abbott or whether or not it was even important to you how the case actually settled, because it recites that it was an agreed judgment. Now, to me, what that means is there was a settlement and the court had to approve it because some of the children were minors. But it does not say in how the original settlement was worked out. In other words, did the settlement agreement between, and I can't remember the entity that settled, but if the settlement agreement says we're going to pay the plaintiffs X number of dollars and the court then just subsequently distributed the money, that is a distinction. Because in this case, the only evidence before the court was there was one settlement agreement, and that was between Dorothy Short, Walker, and HCA. And then there were the $10. But in the context of what you asked, the, each one of these is a claimant under the statute, under the reading of the statute. Now, Justice Baker, when you wrote the Mobil Oil opinion, you said that when there is a settlement covering some or all of the damages awarded in the judgment, Section 33.012 required the trial court to reduce the judgment accordingly. In this case, what you have is if the claimant, this is 33.012, and here it would be Jorge Flores, along with each individual family member, has settled with one or more persons, the court shall further reduce the amount of damages to be recovered by Jorge and each one of the individual beneficiaries, or derivative claimants in that case. And because they all received money by the judgment, in accordance with y'all's view in Mobil Oil, it would mean that that entire amount has to come back. In other words, they are all related because he is still alive. Now, in the wrongful death context, that just doesn't work because, as you pointed out, he can no longer make a claim because he's dead. He cannot make a settlement. Therefore, each one of these is a claimant, and there's nothing in the middle to connect them. There can be no award in the judgment unless he would have settled before his death, and that certainly isn't the case here.
What then would be the purpose of them adding the wrongful death language in 33011? What's the effect of that?
The effect of that is to allow each trial court to reduce the amount of percentage of fault to each of the beneficiaries to whatever the deceased individual is negligent. For instance, what it says is that Clifton Short was 20% negligent. You have to say that they're both the claimant.
There's nothing in here about percent of fault. This is a reduction in the amount of damages.
Right. For credit. But you have to go back. What we're talking about now is solely the definition of claimant.
Right.
And claimant is used in 3301, 33001, 32012, and each one of those. And in 33012, all it refers to is you shall reduce the amount of damages awarded to a claimant by settlement from the claimant.
Here's what I'm saying. Under your interpretation of 33011, there really is no reason for the legislature to have added the words death of another person.
I must not be explaining it right, because I do think that's important. But I think it's important for another reason. In other words, they defined claimant in that way so that in 33.001, it says a claimant can recover only if his negligence is less than or equal to 50%. Now, in the wrongful death context, very seldom are any of the wrongful death beneficiaries going to be negligent in and of themselves. I mean, there are cases where that can happen. But what they wanted to do is to make sure that you counted this negligence, that is, of the deceased, as imputable to the beneficiaries. That's why they make them the claimant. So that if the claimant's negligence, the claimant being both of those negligence together, operates to reduce the award of each one of the beneficiaries. That's why claimant is defined in that way. And you can also look at 33.012, subsection A, which says that the first part, which says that if the claimant is not barred from recovery under 33.01, in other words, if the claimant's negligence did not exceed 50%, the court shall reduce the amount of damages to be recovered by the claimant with respect to a cause of action by a percentage equal to the claimant's percentage of responsibility. What the legislature was saying is, you consider these a claimant when you're fixing the percentage of responsibility. Therefore, you reduce by, say, 20% negligent, you reduce by 20%, all the way around. Now, what they are arguing is that this equals claimant, that whole circle.
In your view, in Drillex, if one of the family members, one of the children, had settled and not sued, what would have been the effect? How would the settlement be credited? Same way you're arguing here.
With respect to that individual, if you take my view, that is, that if someone settled is no longer part of the case, then they are no longer a claimant. And under Justice Baker's writing in Mobile Oil, which I think everybody agreed on this court that was sitting at the time, is you only, when there is a settlement, covering some or all of the damages awarded in a judgment.
So if one of the as I understand it, if one of the family members, one of the children, had settled in the Drillex case
and gone away,
then the credit would only be given to any settlement received by the people that are still in the seat.
That's correct. And the reason...
Why? But we said, though, we must view the entire Flores family as one claimant. But you say that's just because they were all still in the case.
That's one reason. And it was also because the individual whose claims, the individuals whose injury were the basis of the claim, was still alive and capable of recovering under the judgment. Clifton Short could not recover under the judgment. I mean, this court has said, you know, there's no such thing as a party, an estate party. You have to bring it to a personal representative just for the survival plot. From 1890, the Nelson versus Galveston Railroad case, that this court started saying, hey, even one of these beneficiaries has a separate claim that only applies to that individual. It is the reason that it becomes different, in addition to the fact that they're gone, is that in, as I said, I don't know what the settlement agreement in Drillex, and I don't know if I said it right, Drillex, but I don't know what the settlement agreement provided, if it was a whole settlement. In other words, in your situation, if one of the minors, if it just said we settle with plaintiffs for $200,000 and then the court awarded it all to one of the minors and that minor went away for quit all of her claims, then I wouldn't agree. I would say that that does apply to all the claims.
Well, let me ask you, you make a distinction between Drillex and this case by the fact that Flores was alive in Drillex. But if all the claims are derivative, whether it's a wrongful death or it's a personal injury claim, your arguments, it seems, apply just as well to Flores as here. Each of the people who had a derivative claim, loss of consortium, loss of parental support, and all of that, even if Flores is still alive, is identical to the claim the family has here in Clifton Short's death, which is loss of consortium, loss of parental comfort and solace. So it seems to me the damages being awarded are identical. The only thing that's missing is the individual damages that might go to Mr. Flores that would not go to Mr. Short, except the estate's entitled to get those kinds of damages. If that's not really a distinction, don't you really say Drillex somehow was decided wrong?
No, I struggled. I'll admit to you. I struggled to make a distinction with Drillex. It perhaps has something to do with the fact that the real thrust of the Drillex case involved the admissibility of an expert's opinion. And that there, I looked at the briefing on that case. It was pretty shallow on this issue. I also looked at the Abrams-McIver case that the Houston Court of Appeals has decided, and which Justice Abrams cited to in his opinion, and I don't think that has any application to this case, because in that case there was only one person claiming on behalf of one injured person. So by definition, that is one claimant. But it's totally different in this case when you have these multiple claimants. In order to read the statute the way that they suggest, it would have to read in an action in which a party seeks recovery of damages for the death of another person, claimant includes both the dead person and all of the parties seeking damages on behalf of that or through that dead person. And that simply is not the case.
Do you agree that petitioner's suggestions do remedy the hypothesized inequities in the statute?
No, I do not. The whole basis of settlement is to stop the cause of action. People make settlement decisions based on a variety of reasons. If you say that you're going to be settled but still be a party, it may do away with the incentive to settle entirely. But more likely what it will do is do away with the incentive to be part of the case and cooperate to the extent that you can. For instance, take the scenario of a second wife with first children from a deceased husband. Say that the wife, the second wife, settles, and the reason for her settlement is that she wants to get ceremonially remarried again. Now, the children would have to be burdened by that settlement. And the fact that she is ceremonially remarried would affect the way our society looks at her lost claim. But the sole reason that she settled was that so that she would not have to expose her claim for that. So I don't think it remedies anything, and it goes contrary to everything that this court has said about the effect of settlement. And there is no provision in the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code for submission of any settling claimant. There is, authority for the settling defendant to establish the joint several liability angle, but there's just simply nothing to support this remedy. And the reason they came up with this between Austin Court of Appeals and now is because these scenarios that I present to you, if the court does what they want, are real and they are harmful.
Well, I suppose everything you have said is right. Why shouldn't a trial court or any court that has to apportion this look at what actually happens to the initial money, to the original settlement? In this case, the $200,000, of which $10,000 went to each of the other five, why shouldn't those payments be taken into account and this treated as $10,000 settlement for each of the people who received the money?
Well, there are two ways you can do that. One is statutorily, and that's what we're arguing here about. I say the statute doesn't do that.
Well, the statute is silent on that, but it doesn't. It also may not presume that somebody who takes money immediately gives it to somebody else. And we've got all the law in the Mary Carter cases and everywhere else that they've been developing over the last decade or generation to try to, I suppose, put some fairness overlay on our...
All right, and I agree with you. There was, and we do not dispute, that they had the ability to go to that trial court and to prove that this was a sham, as they said 500,000 times in their brief. They had the ability to put on evidence. They had the ability to call Dorothy Short Walker to trial. They had the ability to try to submit it. We immediately objected when they sought a credit for a Dorothy Short Walker settlement. We immediately objected, letting them know that this issue was in dispute. They didn't do that, though, because at the time of voir dire, they chose to point out the absence of one of the children in an effort to make a trial strategy. It failed. When they appealed to the Court of Appeals, they failed to appeal some of the rulings of the trial court in admitting evidence concerning the issue of sham.
Why should it matter if it's a sham? If money got paid, why shouldn't that just be taken into account?
Well, that's the statutory issue. I'm talking about the issue of should a court always be allowed to protect whether or not the agreements made in its court were not a sham. And that always has been the case. I say that a court always has the ability to discover the true nature of the claim. But the reason they say that this is just a statutory case is because they dropped the ball on the appeal on that issue. So it's not before us. And it certainly is the entitlement of any defendant to go into the trial court and say, hey, this is not fair. And here's why. But they did not do that, and they dropped the ball in the Court of Appeals. It was a factual inquiry. They did not bring the facts forward to the Austin Court of Appeals that issue was decided against them. And the factual inquiry part of it is not before this court. Don't change the statutory part of this argument because they failed to appeal on the factual part of it.
Describe to me, going back to the statute and talking about violence, describe to me, suppose the second wife has some concern about what the evidence might look like if she doesn't settle, and so she chooses to settle. Now, she settles for some amount of money, and the defendant pays some amount of money. Why should not that affect the remaining claims of the remaining heirs under wrongful death?
Because that is not the damage of the other individual beneficiaries. Presumably, a defendant is only going to pay an individual plaintiff the damages that are warranted to that individual plaintiff for those damages. If they pay more than that, then that's just second guessing.
So the argument in this case is Dorothy Short Walker got some sort of amount of money in settlement that the hospital based on its understanding of the case, felt was her damages. That's all she got was what they thought reasonably settled her damages.
All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that in this record, the only evidence of what was sought in that settlement is the settlement agreement itself, as this court has said, is the evidence, the premier evidence of what was agreed.
But your argument is that a defendant would not give to an individual. They would evaluate their case based on the person who they're going to settle with opportunity to gain more than that at, say, a trial.
Exactly.
And so there'd be no basis to define claimant to be anybody other than the individual claimant who's tied to the person who died.
That's right. And
let me ask you one more question. You say you struggled with dry legs. Is it necessary for us to disavow any language in dry legs to reach the result that you're talking about in interpreting the statutes, or does dry legs stand under your analysis?
I can answer that question two ways. And the first would be, if I don't know enough of the facts of Drylex and the manner in which it settled, as I described, whether or not it was a general settlement subsequently divided by the court, then clearly it is not in conflict if you rule in my favor in this case and maintain Drylex as it is. However, if you choose to and just accept my my interpretation, and there is no difference in the manner or method of settlement, the only distinguishing factor is that Dorothy Walker was not submitted to the jury. If you believe that that distinction, as we've argued, is sufficient to make her not a claimant subject to the 33.012 statute, then it is consistent with Drylex. If you reject that and the only thing left is that Dorothy Walker, if you say she was, just because she wasn't there doesn't mean she wasn't a claimant, then I think that the only distinction is this is a wrongful death case and that was not. And you will have to write it in the manner in which I know that your intellect will allow you so that everybody would accept it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Would you like me to remove that?
I'll remove it.
Okay.
Just very briefly, question, do you have to overrule Drylex or Drylex, how do you pronounce it? I believe you do.
Or disavow some language, perhaps.
I think you do. This is why. I think it's unquestionable that Mr. Short, they say he didn't have a cause of action. Yes, he did. That's the estate's cause of action. This court, Hawker versus Lavender, said, under the survival action, it's the damages that Cedar could have brought had he lived. So, yes, he has a cause of action. Second, if you put the approach, Mr. Flores here and his family, what plaintiff's counsel are arguing is you got to look at each one separately. That was argued in Drylex, and this court said, if the legislature had intended that each of the parties seeking recovery for damages for the same person be treated as individual claimants, it could easily have written the statute as follows. In an action in which a party seeks recovery for damages for injury to another person, both the other person and the party seeking recovery damages are claimant. And the court noted, instead, the legislature provided the claimant includes both the other person and the party seeking recovery of damages.
So let me ask you a question now. Even the way the statute's written, the argument is that Ms. Walker would not have received anything from HCA more than what it evaluated she would get as a damage item if the case were tried. Do you agree that that's how the defendant would have settled that case with Ms. Walker? They would not have paid her any more money than what they thought she would be awarded at the time of trial.
I don't agree with that. Because if you have a situation where, again, you have the black sheep of the family, and you're going to log everything out here, then you have gifts coming back, you may pay more because there are going to be these gifts under the paper. And one of the things this court in Drylex and the Houston First Court said in McGovery is the reason we have the language that we do is so we don't have to go through all these mini trials on whether or not it's a sham or a subterfuge.
Well, let me ask you then, what were the damages at the trial that were awarded? Were they awarded based on what Sam Short and Patricia Short's damages were, or were they awarded on something else?
The damages that were awarded at trial were damages sustained by every person carving out Dorothy Short Walker.
So
everybody else was submitted.
Submitted individually with a list under with a finding as to each one individually. So
that's
they were
correct.
Not grouped together.
Just like the Flores case. Now, counsel said, we have not shown any indication there was an intent by the legislature for this to be the law. And again, in our brief, under the Code Construction Act, the court or the legislature said you look at three things. One is you look at what the old law was. And if you go back to 2212A, back in 2212A, you look at the definition of claimant, and it only meant the person seeking recovery as a plaintiff, counterplaintiff, cross-plaintiff. When they passed this statute in 1987, they lumped a bunch more language onto it. And the reason they did was because what the court found in McGovern and what this court adopted in the Drylex case was it was to prevent manipulation of settlements. That was the evil which the legislature sought to cure when they amended the definition of claimant in 1987. So I think there is a fair, clear direction of what the legislature was trying to do when they passed this statute in 1987 and greatly expanded who was a claimant from old 2212A. Finally,
so the argument is that HCA, in some sort of agreement with the plaintiffs, paid more money to Dorothy Short in order to get more money to the children than they anticipated would be awarded by the trial court or something? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what it is, what's the harm of trying to solve the statute?
The deal is, let's, again, say the plaintiff has decided they're going to settle with HCA and they're going to go to trial against Dr. Rice, as in this case. They go to HCA and say, well, if you're willing, we'll really settle everybody, but what we're going to do is we're going to loan all the money to Dorothy Schultz-Walker, and then you'll give everybody else $10. And then we're going to have the gifts going back and forth.
And we're picking Dorothy Schultz-Walker because we figure she'll have the least amount of damages being awarded.
She had not visited the father. She had the least connection with the father during the last few years of her life and was probably the least desirable as far as monetary damages from all the plaintiffs out there. And that's what happened. Again, we've got some illustrations that were attached in some of the articles to our brief to show what can happen and why the legislature drafted the statute as they did to prevent trial courts from having to go through all these hearings on whether or not there's been an attempt to manipulate the settlement credit. And again, as far as whether or not we show the sham or not, I don't think we have to. Because I think this court in Dry Lakes, or the MacGyver court said, we're never going to get to that. We're not going to digress, go down that rabbit trail. We're going to credit everything that was received against the total amount received awarded to the defendants. And we eliminate all these many trials.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in today's causes. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable